Just
so
here.
Are we ready for this?
No.
Welcome to the Bowie Book Club. My name is Christian.
I am Greg.
And we have had a book club for over a decade. We read a lot of books. Sometimes we talked about them.
Mostly we just got drunk and gossiped.
But at the sad loss of David Bowie in 2016, we decided to get our act together and read through his list of 100 most influential books in no particular order.
In fact, in a completely nonsensical order.
And make wild speculation as we went.
So what do we read this time?
English Journey by J.B. Priestley. I'll hold it up so you can see it. It's a lovely illustrated version that both of us found.
Yeah, finally we both, for the first time in a long time, we read the same edition of the same book.
And by accident, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because there's been a couple that they only have one edition, right, like Maldoror. Right.
There's only one of that.
And I think we both listened to the audiobook of Hawksmoor because we didn't have the printed version.
Right. And we only just got the printed version this year.
Which is so exciting.
Yeah.
But this one is the Folio Society. And it looks like a yearbook. And it has, I mean, really, like it's embossed with the 1933 across repetitious. And then there's like photos of like a group of miners, only one of which is smiling. And then there's like trams, which J.B. Priestley hated.
He hated a lot of things.
And this is that house in the Cotswolds, I think.
Right. Yeah. One of the first things he talks about in the book. And he gradually becomes grumpier as the journey goes on.
But the photos are great. It really helps with.
Yeah. Really adds to it.
Yeah. Like you get to see what you're hearing about in the story in a way that helps. Like, I know we're readers and we believe that we can make our own
mental pictures,
but sometimes the historic pictures help when you're reading something.
Yeah, and kind of the sad thing is that it felt like half the things that were pictured in the book were destroyed either, you know, in World War II or were, you know, torn down in the 60s to put up council housing or whatever. So there's an element, I think, of not nostalgia necessarily, but there's an element of like, this is a world that's past in a way.
And interestingly, in this book, which is written in 1934, the trip is in 1933, but the book is published in 1934. He's already complaining about that.
Right.
He's already complaining like, there used to be something better here.
And that if there's one takeaway from the book, you know, it's that he thinks that the old is better.
So who is this grumpy guy?
Who is this old grump?
John Boynton Priestley. Boynton? Is that right?
That sounds about right.
J.B. J.B. Priestley. He was a novelist initially, and then he started writing plays and apparently was super successful.
Yeah, very popular writer.
Screenwriter, broadcaster. You do mention that he is a popular writer. Which can be taken in many different ways.
If you're Virginia Woolf, it has a very particular meaning.
Yeah.
Kind of derogatory.
Yeah, so she, partly because he wrote a negative review of one of her books.
literary catfight.
She called him, she dismissed him as middle brow. And kind of, there was him and some other writers that she sort of grouped together and called the tradesmen of letters.
Dis.
And it's funny because that's still today, you know, an issue where people have this idea of like, oh, if you like sold in the airport bookstore, you're a tradesman of letters.
Right. Or Stephen, you know, you're Stephen King.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. There's a number of authors that I think we can all kind of point to as like, oh, yeah, you just have like a factory or something that you're just turning out books.
Like artificial intelligence is generating the next Michael Crichton novel or whatever.
Well, I think someone like Danielle Steele, who died a couple of years ago, she had like people writing for her. She would do, it's kind of like a Thomas Kincaid thing. Like,
yeah,
you would have an idea and then you would sketch it out and someone would fill it out for you.
Man.
I mean, is that, maybe, is that telling stories out of school?
I don't know if this podcast is the spilling tea kind of podcast, but.
So this tradesman of letters, he didn't really like being called that. But he picked fights back, and there, and he, you know, ragged on the highbrow and the lowbrow, and the battle of the brows persisted for like a decade.
Man.
Yeah, there was like, they wrote articles, like snarky articles back and forth. Not necessarily Virginia Woolf, but like this idea of highbrow and lowbrow being dismissed versus middlebrow being dismissed. And it was like articles and radio interviews.
And they recorded diss records.
And it kind of reminded me of what he said about the army also.
Because he served in World War One. Mm-hmm. And it really changed him, as it did for, you know, so many people of his generation.
He was like buried alive with, I don't know if it was a, like an explosion.
Yeah, like a mortar fell on the trench he was in, and that's just terrifying.
Yeah, and just like tons of scary stuff, you know, you're gassed and you're fighting for your life, and he didn't come out of it very optimistic about England.
Yeah, yeah.
Or not, I shouldn't say about England, about military leadership.
Right. I think it changed his sort of class consciousness.
Yeah, there's this great quote. I think it's from his memoir that he published in 1962. It's called Margin Released. And he says, quote, "The British command specialized in throwing men away for nothing. The tradition of an officer class defying both imagination and common sense killed most of my friends as surely as if those cavalry generals had come out of the chateau with polo mallets and beaten their brains out."
Holy moly.
Call this class prejudice if you like, so long as you remember that I went into the war without any such prejudice, free of any class feeling. No doubt I came out with it, with a chip on my shoulder, a big, heavy chip. Probably some friend's thigh bone.
Wow.
Ow.
I mean, that's strongly worded.
And it's particularly class focused. Like, the people in charge of throwing away people are wealthy, and the people who are being thrown away don't have any power.
Much like depicted in the classic Black Sabbath song, War Pigs. Which I'm assuming was inspired by J.B. Priestley, of course.
Yes, I'm sure there's a direct through line. Yeah. That, you know, Priestley was at the heart of that one.
Yeah. He was on the first Sabbath record.
Apparently, he was really, like, kind of a rock star in his time.
It sounds like he was really famous, a real celebrity. Surprisingly... In some ways, really progressive and really radical in his thinking, but also really mainstream in the sense that his books were really popular, his plays were really popular. He was on the radio, you know. He got commissions to write books like this. So it's interesting that he mixes sort of this, not conservative, but sort of middlebrow, you know, yeah. Sensibility, right, but also like these sort of radical ideas about economics and about how people are treated. But he also retains some of this sort of Victorian prejudices, you know, and racism, essentially. Yeah. Like, and they're all kind of mixed up in this book too.
Yeah. So Churchill, the right didn't like Priestley. He had a series of, what were they called? Postscripts?
Postscripts, yep.
So he would like do a radio hour, you know, during World War II.
Right.
And it was kind of like the old like Lake Wobegon stories thing. He would just tell like little cute stories about like there was a bombing in this town and the pie didn't get injured or something, like just like weird, happy, or not happy, but like, at the end, it would make you feel uplifted, I guess, which is very middlebrow, isn't it?
Right, right.
And they were extremely popular. There's this great quote from Graham Greene. He says, "Priestley became, in the months after Dunkirk, a leader second only in importance to Mr. Churchill. And he gave us what our other leaders have always failed to give us, an ideology."
Wow. I mean, it seems like he had a really... quite an effect on the British public, and Churchill maybe just didn't like the competition.
Yeah, he did. He was socialist, I think. He started the he started the common, he was one of the co-founders of the Socialist Commonwealth Party. And so it was a tricky thing to negotiate at that time.
Yeah. And in the book, he talks about a young communist that he meets, and he speaks of him, you know, very highly.
Bob.
His name was Bob. And he liked Bob a lot, but he said, there isn't yet a party that is worthy of Bob.
Yeah.
Not Bob from Twin Peaks, because that's the scary Bob.
Wait, wasn't Bob a communist?
He was. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and he said he disagreed with, you know.
Yeah, he goes to the communist meetings with him. So yeah, let's. So in the book, it's a travel log. I'm doing air quotes. It's a travel log because this isn't like, I'm going to go to England and find out where I should go on vacation. I'm going to take English
to the Lake District. Yeah. Or, you know, I'm going to go to Brighton and the seaside and see the chalk, you know, the chalk hills or whatever.
Yeah, this isn't that travel log. This is, I think now we would call it more like popular social science or something.
Like sociology, yeah.
Yeah, because it's about the place, but it's really about the people and what affects the present situation. This is, you know, 1933, post-World War I.
Deep in the Depression.
And what's happening with people.
And he does have, you know, a lot of the book is about the effect, again, of decisions that the government makes on working people. Or in this case, people who aren't working, and the effects of not working, what it has on them and how that affects where they live in this kind of compounding effect.
Yeah, he had some of the chapters that I liked a lot. You know, he starts in London and he goes down to Hold on, I have the map right here.
There's a very sibilant pause there.
Okay, so he starts in London, he goes down to Southampton, then he goes up to Bristol, then he goes to the Cotswolds, then Birmingham or Leicester. I can't remember what order, but he basically goes straight up kind of along the west side of England, not at all mentioning Wales. Wales
right,
doesn't exist.
Just skips Wales altogether.
Don't look to your left. Look to your left.
This is an English journey, England only.
And he goes all the way up to like Manchester and Liverpool, Blackpool. I think the furthest north he goes is up
Newcastle. Yeah.
And Durham. And that's like the mining.
Right. In the Black Country.
Yeah. And then he comes back down and kind of goes on the west side. And he seems more positive about some places than other places.
Right. Like he really liked Bristol and the Cotswolds, where he meets a genuine eccentric and spends a little bit of time with this guy who lives in a kind of rundown old mansion.
Oh, who's making like the model.
Yeah, miniature seaport. And he says something about his exquisite absorption with the utterly useless or something like that, which I think is the motto for this podcast.
exquisitely absorbed and utterly useless.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and it makes sense that, you know, that he's happier because I think it's the beginning of the trip. He hasn't yet caught a cold, because it seems like for the rest of the trip, he has a cold.
Or he says at one point, maybe I spoke highly about this place because I didn't get a cold and I thought I was going to. And then maybe I spoke poorly of this place because I had a cold.
And occasionally he reminds the reader, he says, I would like to remind the reader of the swarming bacteria.
Yeah, he doesn't sound like he's particularly into traveling. And he does not like a lot of things. He'll go to a town and say like, there's nothing wrong with this town, except it's stupid.
He actually said that. That is a verbatim quote.
Or there was one where he said, I wanted to praise it, but I also don't ever want to live here. I would never want to live here.
But there are things sprinkled throughout that he's enthusiastic about. And the people he meets, I think, he's enthusiastic about. But I think, yeah, I think he just doesn't like traveling. And maybe, I don't think he would do this except that he was contracted to, you know.
And I don't know what his contract said. So apparently he was commissioned to do this book. And there were some other people at the time that were also commissioned to do like travel essays about places. Someone was writing The Scottish Journey, Edwin Muir. And George Orwell was also commissioned, and he wrote The Road to Wigan Pier. So they were trying to kind of collect portraits of the area. It's sort of like Dorothea Lange's photos in America. You know, here's what's going on. Pay attention. Take a look around. So he looks at industry a lot. I don't know what his contract said, if it was like, please go out and paint a lovely portrait of England. Right, yeah. And he's like,
they did not get that.
I'm going to look at how everyone's unemployed.
Right.
And it's pretty heavy because he talks about, I think there was some, I didn't put it in our notes. There was some statistic about how much industry had been lost that between, you know, World War One and when he's writing this, these industries are just bankrupted.
And then these towns that he says were essentially built as dormitories for these factories.
Kind of like company towns.
Yeah, were decimated. And I think that's where, you know, he reserves his sort of ire for, not for the people that live there because it's not their fault, but...
But like poor planning.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, and planning to... insert humans as cogs in this money-making machine.
He's also very upset. So he doesn't like the architecture. He, you know, this kind of early model suburb of like, this is just dead land. It's just houses in a circle and houses in a circle. And they just all are people who just go to this job and now this job is gone. Right. So why would you ever live here?
Right, right.
And there's some great industry. He's very positive about the Cadbury company, that they have like sort of utopian little community that has all these like lectures and performances and all this, you know, these parks and
all centered around the factory.
And that was what he said, like, that's very nice, but what if they don't want to go to those things? There's something.
What if they want something else with their lives?
And there was one of the towns he drives into. It's a Sunday, and the only options are going to a like Salvation Army sing along or going to a like seedy dive pub. And he's like, damn it, these are terrible choices.
And he says, if I had a child of 18, I would want them to be able to go out on the town and enjoy themselves and see a play or go to a pub that isn't terrible, you know.
And he criticizes America as well as the planners of these towns, because so as much as the planners of these towns sort of have created these deserts for people to live in, America has stripped away any national culture and filled it in with like movie culture and like it just imported, like all the girls are dressing like movie stars instead of having regional style, and all the movie, like the playhouses have turned into movie theaters,
and they're just all showing Hollywood movies.
Yeah, and they don't have anything to do with the region. It's this imported entertainment,
kind of cheap culture, and
he has some racist jabs at American music.
It's where his sort of Victorian sort of backwardness kind of really comes out in a sort of ugly way. Wall is still making, I think, a valid point about the sort of cheapening of culture. It's unfortunate that he had to kind of, you know, lend this sort of racist tinge to it. But there is a sort of like nationalist sort of England as the center of the universe, and everything outside of England being inferior, that kind of comes across in the book as well. And I think he's sort of talking about like the loss of English character, and in some ways talking about the loss of English empire too, where, you know, America is now the center. Not that that's any better, but
Yeah, his... I can't remember where I read it, but someone pointed out he doesn't judge the people for being interested in America. He judges, I guess it's this mysterious other that has put it there instead. Like, he seems very, I don't know if he likes the quote unquote common people that he meets along the way, except for Bob. He really likes Bob. But he's also not blaming them for their state of being, which I think he points out in a number of cases. He does this really interesting style in one chapter up in, there was one town there were certain places that were like the worst. I think it was up in the Newcastle area.
Yeah, I think when he gets into the mining towns.
Jarrow.
Yeah, right.
He's just like, these people live in squalor. And he sort of has this, home reports where he like walks through homes and says, these are the people living in this home. This is how much they live on. This is what they have to pay for. This is their amount of destitution. And just
kind of inventory.
Yeah. And it was kind of magnetic reading, as hard as it was to read. And there's a bit of this feeling like, don't blame these people. You know, their industry is taken away from them or something. So he's not saying like, ugh, these people are so stupid. They won't go to see my play. They want to go see a movie.
Right, right.
It's like it's not up to them. Which
yeah.
I'm a little conflicted about the agency that he doesn't give people as well.
Right. He does show that people like Bob or some of the other people that he meets are showing their own agency. And he speaks really highly of, you know, the theater group that he encounters, you know, and... Or the people who are organizing.
Well, he doesn't speak well of their talent. He speaks very poorly of their talent.
Well, so he does kind of mix it in that. He's like, oh, I'm glad they're doing it. They're just not very good at it.
He's such a grump.
But there's a sense where, where he's complaining, or not complaining, but he makes it clear that he thinks that something needs to change in how things are structured, but he doesn't. And maybe this is for the good. He doesn't try to give an answer. He doesn't pretend that he has the answer. He just knows that this isn't fair or this isn't right.
But that's what I'm curious about his World War II radio broadcasts, whether those were his... Because apparently there was answers there. Like, he kind of laid out plans for social services or something. And I don't know, because I haven't listened to them. But I wonder whether he went from this kind of... eye-opening journey, and then from this, let's just say from this, he developed some, you know, thoughts about, in the same way of like, I served in this military, look at this class divide,
right.
I'm gonna go think about this. And then I drove around the country and I saw that the wool and the cotton weaving industry are destitute, and the potters are still doing okay, but then the shipbuilding and like all these other industries are just gone. And I think something should be done about it.
No one is taking care of these people.
And the list, this like list in Jarrow that he has, where like they're making this little, and the government says they're living large. And
right, right.
Yeah. He has it's not exactly the middle brow, the battle of the brows, but in some way it is. It's like, you don't actually know what you're addressing. You're all in London. You don't know what you're addressing here.
Right, right. And at the same time, like, and I think he speaks to this a little bit, there is the conflict of like, he is a successful writer. He has a car with a driver. He's well off. But yet he sees all this poverty around him and wants to have something done about it.
Here's a quote from in the chapter To the Tyne. So he's between Wallsend and North Shields. The road was confusing, and the landscape more confusing still. It was strewn with broken down pitmen's cottages and the ruins of higgledy-piggledy allotments. I never saw a bit of country that was more in urgent need of tidying up. If any decent woman had been shown a room half as bad as this, she would have itched to be at it. If T.S. Eliot ever wants to write a poem about a real wasteland instead of a metaphysical one, he should come here.
Take that, TS.
Yeah, we are fond of saying that people get used to things, but I do not believe that anybody can look complacently at a dirty mess of this kind.
And it does, there is, The Road to Wigan Pier is very similar, I think, in the sense of this sort of outrage about how working people are treated. And it's sort of surprising. I think one of the facts that you pulled up is that Orwell kind of blacklisted Priestley during World War II, I think, from working for, I guess, government propaganda? Is that what it was?
It was the... So apparently Orwell had made a list. He worked for the Information Research Department in 1949, and it was a unit in the Foreign Office of the Labor Government. And he considered the people on this list to have pro-communist leanings and so unsuitable to write for their publications.
Wow.
So, yeah, interesting that they had the... Because the whole time I was reading this book, I kept thinking of Down and Out in Paris and London, Orwell's book.
Which was came a little bit before?
This year, actually.
The same year?
It was... Not the year that this book was published, but the year it was written.
Okay.
So he published Down and Out in Paris and London in
33,
I think. Yeah. But it was so on my mind, like, yeah, this is, I mean, Priestley's take is a little more, there's some funny parts, there's some, you know, jabs, there's some, Down and Out was like, I'm going to live with these people and try to survive, and it's hard, and I hate it.
But I think they have the same notions in mind, but maybe different approaches to how to talk about it and also like what to do about it.
But apparently they didn't see eye to eye.
Yeah, he had another beef.
And because Orwell was highbrow.
Ah, okay, so we're back to the brows again.
Yes, back to the battle of the brows. It will persist.
Yes. So why Bowie?
I mean...
Or maybe a different question is, when Bowie?
Yeah, that was the one that... I would have to believe that he read this later in his life because he was so pro-America. You know, he was into black music.
He wanted to be Little Richard.
Yeah, he was into the music and the film and everything about America. So this, the amount of like negative side eye that's cast at American cultural influence in Priestley's book probably wouldn't have sat well with a young Bowie. So
yeah.
I've got to believe it's a little bit older. You know, he left Britain and didn't ever live there again. So maybe there was a bit of like an attempt to learn about the country that you left and the history of it.
Once you have some perspective on it. And I think because, you know, he grew up in London. He was and I think from a Londoner's perspective, the north of England is almost like a foreign country in a way.
So this would have been to him like an interesting book about people he doesn't know either.
Right, yeah. Different sensibility altogether.
And the period just before he was born, really. So it's kind of what was the area I was entering when I showed up.
Right, yeah. What were my parents experiencing, essentially? Yeah. Mr. and Mrs. Bowie.
Yeah, so I kind of think... You know, he watched Britain from the outside for most of it. I mean, he would visit, you know, but he didn't reside there anymore. So, yeah, maybe it was just to reconnect.
Yeah, yeah. And as he got older, you know, he became more interested in history. And this sort of fits into that.
Yeah, good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's why.
Yeah.
So there.
Yeah, I think we solved it.
Mm-hmm.
So what else are you reading?
You know what, actually? What? Because David Bowie is probably really like a vampire who keeps living and living and living. He was probably already alive at this time. And one of the characters in this book is him.
But which one?
I don't know.
Bob?
He might be Bob.
Aha!
Oh!
One of his many personas.
There. I think that's why.
Okay. That's a much better story.
I really like reading about myself in 1933.
I'm glad JB liked me.
I like that idea better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were you asking me?
Oh, so what else are you reading?
Oh, I just finished two books that are very, very different.
Mm.
One is called Red Island House by Andrea Lee, and it's It almost feels like a group of short stories. It's like years that this family lives or you know, spends their summers at their house in Madagascar. And it's like an African-American woman who's married an Italian man and their relationship to this island, which is really interesting because she is sort of viewed as like one of us on the island, though she's not part of the island at all. And then her husband is like one of the white colonial presences. And it was an interesting family and cultural tale about Madagascar. And then the other book was Gideon the Ninth, which is about necromancers.
Oh, that is very different.
Yeah. It was very fun. Yeah. One of the best portrayals of two characters hating each other delightfully.
Wow. Like Orwell and Priestley.
Yes. Just like that. But as necromancers.
They could have been. Never know.
What are you reading?
I'm still working on The Moonstone.
Wilkie Collins.
Yeah, which I'm enjoying, but it's a couple pages a day kind of thing. Mm. And same thing with Black Leopard, Red Wolf.
Oof, I liked that.
It's a really good book, but it's, you know, like...
Violent.
Yeah, very violent. And it would make an incredible movie or an incredible comic book.
Oh, it's got to be. They've got to be making that. Yeah. It's got to be a series.
Totally. It would be. I mean, he is really, you know, I think he said his intention was to make like an African Lord of the Rings or an African Game of Thrones.
Totally. Yeah. It's such a vibrant, like, I can still picture how I pictured characters, like such a rich cast and intense.
And it definitely nods towards, you know, cinematic dialogue and sort of like really cinematic set pieces. It does feel like it's written for film.
The little orphan.
Yeah.
Those who were like, I won't say.
They have different magical powers.
Yeah, they have weird magical powers.
Yeah, it's a lot of interesting character portrayals.
Yeah.
So I'm excited. You know, like I'm excited in some ways. I'm taking it slowly and savoring it.
Mm-hmm.
But it does feel like the kind of book that you could read. You know, just not, you could totally binge it too.
I read that around the same time that I read the series Children of Blood and Bone. I think it's Adiyen. I can't remember her name. But they're both this kind of, not Afrofuturism, but like Afrofantasy,
mm-hmm.
like this other Africa and just this rich cultural fantasy history. And sometimes I feel like I mix the worlds into one another, but I like them kind of mixed into one another. In my mind, they are in the same world.
You're kind of making your own crossover.
Yeah, because the Children of Blood and Bone is a YA series.
Mm-hmm.
And
do not let your children
hear.
Yeah. For Bloomsday, we're recording a couple of days after Bloomsday, I did my annual read of two more pages of Ulysses.
So, man, you're going to be done any decade now. That was one of the first books we read for book club.
Yeah, that was one of our one of our first pre-Bowie book club books.
One of these days, we'll go back to it.
Yep, we'll complete the circle,
mm-hmm.
and we'll read the incomprehensible book or semi-comprehensible.
Yep.
But I'm reading it with the Ulysses Annotated, which is the notes basically on every line.
That's intense.
Yeah, it is. It's I really like doing it, but yeah.
Does it tell you what kind of soap he carries?
Yes, it does go into...
Really?
into the brand. It goes into the history of the shop.
Wow.
And it's amazing, you know, that Ulysses does accurately portray Dublin on that day in that year. And the annotations really show how the level of detail and the level of either research or incredible memory that Joyce had.
So or maybe he just made it up.
And maybe these annotations are completely made up too.
See? Maybe he did it and he's still around.
Whoa.
Like Bob Bowie.
Another necromancer.
Necromancer's on the brain. So what else are you going to read this month, next month?
Oh, yes. So our next book for the book club is Vile Bodies by Evelyn Waugh.
Who I used to think was a woman. When I remember seeing Evelyn Waugh in the bookstores when I was a kid, and I was like, I've never read her.
But now you know, because now you're highbrow.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm middle. What kind of brow would I have?
You're no brow.
I have no brow.
But we got different editions, but we both got vintage paperbacks, and I think
they're both Dell, like little Dell pocket books, which is adorable.
They both smell incredible, like old books,
like rotting paper.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And we'll post on Instagram. We'll post a picture of them because the covers are wild.
Because they're adorable. Yeah. I don't know yet, but I suspect that the cover art has nothing to do with the story.
Yes, I think that we know for sure.
It's like a pulp novelist kind of, yeah.
Oh, almost forgot. What song do we pick for this book?
Oh, that's right. We went back and forth because we thought about using Always Crashing the Same Car.
Because it's a great song.
And because Priestley said he was a really terrible driver. So he has a driver drive him around. And so we kept thinking, Always Crashing the Same Car. And also because it's about, you know, the cyclical nature of, you know, the crashes and the recovery and crashes and recovery. And this is 33. And then it happened again in the 80s. And maybe it's happening again now.
Yeah.
But instead, we chose This Is Not America.
From the Falcon and the Snowman soundtrack, for all you Sean Penn fans out there.
And partly because what really stood out a number of times was how judgmental he was about American influence on Britain. And also there was this short films called An English Journey Reimagined. And it was a series of performances, I think about 10 years ago, maybe a little more. And it was Ian Sinclair and Alan Moore were the two authors who were involved in starting it.
Like both of them are steeped in psychogeographics.
Yep, and that's what they say it is. They are the authors and psychogeographers, Ian Sinclair and Alan Moore. And so it started with the idea of this Priestley book going and tracing the same route again. And the spot in the first video that they go is this like nuclear bomb base that was like secretly built and no one was supposed to know it was there. It was this Cold War thing. And he talks about how it's just very American paranoia and American architecture.
Mm.
And this is now, you know, and just recognizing the influence that America had on Britain during that time. And so there was some part that I liked the reminder that these are not, this is not America.
Right, right, which Priestley seemed to be saying.
And I had to keep reminding myself because I would make connections to the American Depression and to the experiences that I think about in this country, but then to remind myself, this book is not about America.
Right, right.
And so, I don't know what the influences are on this country.
Right, right. So there you have it.
And it's a fun song.
Yeah.
What's shooby-dooby-doo?
Sha-la-la-la-la. All right.
So that's it.
Yeah.
So you can always find us on the BowieBookClub.com, mm-hmm. on the Twitter at BowieBookPod.
On the Facebooks at Bowie Book Club Podcast.
And the Instagram at Bowie Book Club.
And check out our list on bookshop.org. If you buy from our list, you help support the podcast. In fact, you helped pay for our server costs for the year.
Yay, thank you.
And for some of our books. So thank you for that.
And it also helps support indie bookstores around the country.
Which is still very important.
And Bookshop is opened up in the UK now as well.
Yeah.
So which is not America.
Sha-la-la-la-la. Okay. I guess we'll see you all in about a month.
Bye.
I can't believe I did that.
I'm glad you did that.
Sha-la-la-la. do that again.
Stereo.
Is that like four-dimensional sound? Is
stereo. This is my ASMR career.
Still going on.
Huh? Oh yeah, it's going strong.